Very quickly, want to introduce Durba Ghosh, who's a historian here at Cornell, a historian of modern South Asia. And she focuses on the history of colonialism and writes quite, has written extensively on gender, culture, law, archives, and colonial governance in 18th and 19th century India. She's very interested in sort of this everyday histories that occur in families and households. In terms of my life here at Cornell, you know, Durba was the co-director of the South Asia program for a while, and in that role engaged many of us, many faculty across the university, in a number of sort of interesting conversations. And she's very sort of generous with her time and her intellectual energy, which is always a wonderful thing. And so what Durba's going to do, and so, you know, hence our invitation to her to come here today to not just introduce Suketu, but also to, I think, to sort of set off a conversation about his talk that he's going to be doing on storytelling in the city. So with that, Durba.
It's a great pleasure to introduce Suketu Mehta to you today for a talk that's titled Storytelling and the City. It's an elegant way, I think, to explain what he does for a living, storytelling and writing about cities. But I don't want to equate this elegant title either for simplicity or for something that is frozen as a classic. Suketu Mehta is one of those rare writers whose writing is both lyrical, funny, informative, and always elegant. His well-known book, Maximum Cities, Bombay Lost and Found, which was published in 2007 to great acclaim, is an incredibly rich and complex rendering of one of the world's most well-known cities. It has the virtue of combining a great deal of research with stunningly evocative writing that brings home how Mumbai remains both cosmopolitan and deeply parochial. Through Maximum Cities, we learn such phrases as Power Tony, about police interrogations that rely on feeding suspects jalebis. I'll only let you read that. It's on page 232 about how that works. And about ways that ordinary citizens inhabit a place of extreme desires and extreme discomforts. In the process of researching his book on Bombay, Mehta met mafia men, men who work for the Shiv Sena, police officers, film directors, dancing girls, and Amitabh Bachchan, who must occupy his own category, I think. In Suketu's hands, these figures become storytellers in their own right, which I think is a sign both of his skill and his integrity in making ordinary people and events seem extraordinary. Maximum Cities had a maximum impact. Suketu became involved in the creation of the film Mission Kashmir, and his friend Vikram Chandra wrote an epic novel called Sacred Games, and if you haven't read Sacred Games or seen it, it's very useful as a doorstop or to prop yourself up if you're not able to reach something. But if you've read Sacred Games, as I have, it's surprisingly close to some of the things that Suketu reports in Maximum Cities. There are, of course, many, many novels on Bombay, Fine Balance, many of Rushdie's novels. But one of the interesting things about Vikram Chandra's novel is its unique blend of fiction and reality. And when you read it, and if you read Maximum Cities, you can see where he got his inspiration. Maximum Cities is technically not fiction, but at its core, it's great storytelling. And it takes storytelling to a high art form that is attentive to and draws from a deeply humanistic and literary sensibility. With the success of Maximum Cities behind him, it won a number of prizes and it was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, Mehta has turned to writing about New York, the city in which he lives now. He was awarded a prestigious Guggenheim Fellowship to examine immigrant lives in New York City. And in an early incarnation of the project, he noted, quote, how an immigrant can come to a big expensive city like New York or San Francisco without papers, without money, without housing, and make a new life. It's the promise of the big city that allows us to remake ourselves, and it provides us with new forms of creativity, desire, and the subject of much of the last few days' conversations, design and social transformation. I think many of us are emotionally and sentimentally attached to cities. Suketu was born in Calcutta and spent his childhood in Bombay. Many of us in the room, I think, grew up in New York, as I did, and living in Ithaca, as we do, we're an odd tribe. We maintain the quaint habits of our former urban selves. I still read the New York Times on most days, and I subscribe to the New Yorker, reading the events section and talk of the town with great care, even though I don't leave Ithaca very often. Several years ago, in November 2008, I was living in Calcutta with my family when news of the attack of the flagship Taj Hotel in Bombay flashed across my computer screen. It happened late on a Wednesday night in India. It was the Wednesday before American Thanksgiving. And we woke to the news of the battle between militants and police forces that had raged the whole night. Many of us know what happened in subsequent days at the Taj and at other hotels nearby, at the Cafe Leopold, at Chabad House, and at Victoria Terminus. I did what many of us do when we're far from home. I read my local newspaper on the web. So I turned to the New York Times, and I found one of the loveliest and inspiring pieces I read in the days that followed those horrifying events. It was a piece written by Sukethu. And for those of us who identify, I think, as New Yorkers, it was reminiscent of an incredibly thoughtful, moving pieces that appeared in the aftermath of September 2001. This is what he wrote in the final paragraphs of this very short piece that came out in the Times. Quote, "But the best answer to the terrorists is to dream bigger, make even more money, and visit Mumbai more than ever. Dream of making a good home for all Mumbaikers, not just the denizens of $500 a night hotel rooms. Dream not just of Bollywood stars like Aishwarya Rai or Shah Rukh Khan, but of clean running water, humane mass transit, better toilets, a responsive government. Make a killing not in God's name, but in the stock market. And turn up the forbidden music and dance, work hard and party harder." I think it's the best way to end an introduction to Sukethu Mehta, so I'd like to welcome him now.
Thank you, Durba, for that extremely generous introduction. You should be doing all my introductions at all my events. The theme of the symposium has me thinking about cars and storytelling. I grew up in the India of the 1970s, where buying a car was no small thing. You had to register for a car for years. And when the lucky day came, you felt blessed, literally. I remember when my family in Bombay got lucky enough to be allotted a small Fiat. The first thing we did was take it to the temple and perform a car puja, like in Bijoy's slide. We put vermilion on it, garlanded it, waved lamps around it, and broke a coconut on its hood. And then we took pictures of it and sent it back to my grandparents in Calcutta to prove that we were well set in Bombay. It was important that the car be blessed by the deities and also that we had documentary evidence of our success. I saw the same thing 30 years later in Queens, in New York, among a family of Bangladeshi immigrants. Immigrants all over the world, having forsaken family and friends in order to move, then face a mighty task, convincing the family and friends in the home country that it was worth it, that standards are high, that tests stern. So I have a young Bangladeshi friend in Jamaica, in Queens, whose parents have a Mercedes-Benz parked in the driveway of their small, simple home in this working-class neighborhood. All those who come to their home must first walk around the Benz. They bought it with the first savings they made it in America, $7,000. "What kind of Mercedes can you buy with $7,000? I asked my friend. "Does it run?" "It runs all right. So what's the catch? What's wrong with it?" "Well, the wipers stopped working a while ago, and we can't afford to buy new wipers." "So what do you do when it rains?" "Before we drive anywhere, we always check the weather forecast." "And if it rains while you're driving?" "We always keep a subway map in the glove compartment. If it starts raining, we park it and get into the nearest subway and come back for it after it stops raining." The Benz is practically useless for the family, but it serves a higher function. It communicates to the people back in Dhaka that the family is well set. And sending back pictures or videos of the family standing around the Benz is not subterfuge, not exactly. Yes, it's true that my friend's parents have retired, and his sister recently lost her job in the marketing department of a food magazine, and my friend will have to turn over half of his paycheck to his parents to help them meet the mortgage of the house. So the image symbolized by the Benz may not reflect the true reality of their precarious situation, But it is a necessary deception. And besides, it doesn't hurt anyone. And the truth is that the immigrant lives in a world of lies all the time. The immigrant has to lie for survival. The immigrant has to walk about with a collection of masks. As another one of my friends, a 27-year-old Congolese woman, explained what it meant to live without papers in 21st century America, quote, "You are not you. Most of the time, you are someone else." Lying is a form of storytelling, and storytelling puts the people back into cities. What is the story of a city? What is the story of Mumbai, of New York? It depends on who's telling it and who's listening. Every city has two types of narratives, the official story and the unofficial story. The official story has buzz and flash about it. The unofficial story is quieter, but it is the one that is more likely to endure. The unofficial story is largely orally transmitted. You can listen to it in the phone centers, in the immigrant quarters of our cities, in the CDs and videos that are made by individuals and sent back to their families, in the popular ballads and folk songs of Bollywood films and telenovelas. It is the news of the city that migrants carry back to the village. Most of the time, these stories are inaccessible to outsiders, partly for reasons of language and partly because the technology is so primitive. In Mumbai, for example, there is a community of letter writers who sit opposite the general post office, who help illiterate migrants craft letters back to their relatives in the village. These letters are nowhere recorded in historians' archives. When the villager moves to the city, the first thing he sends back home is not money, it's a story. Unofficial migrant stories are essential to maintain a kind of continuity for people on the move. For most of our history as a species, we have not been attuned to radical, continuous movement. We have stayed in one place, in our villages. But in the past quarter of a century, the world's migrant population has doubled. Today, there are over 200 million people who are living in a country different from the one they were born in. My own family has moved all over the world, from India to Kenya to England to the USA and back again, and is still moving. Like all migrants, our consolation through this relentless movement consists in storytelling. Recollection, recollection, as an antidote to dislocation. In New York, my American-born children sit with my mother as she tells them stories her father told her about Nairobi, and with my father as he tells them about his grandfather in rural Gujarat. With these story fibers, we darn patches over the holes of the quilt of time. I was educated as a writer in a balcony in North Calcutta, the playground of a modern apartment block in Bombay, and in the cafeteria of a brutal Catholic school in Jackson Heights. First there was the seeing, then there was the filtering of experience. I come from three generations of diamond merchants. My grandfather, my father, and my uncle all like to tell stories. In the diamond trade, it's all about the specific. You can't judge a whole group of people, for example, Jews, whether one can trust them in business or not. It has to be that particular Jew. Knowing the individual quirks of character of your customer in a business built entirely on trust makes the difference between bankruptcy and fortune. So the men of my family were experts at character analysis and transmitted that knowledge to each other through stories. The diamond business is not something you go to business school to learn. You listen to stories. In Calvino's invisible city of Euphemia, the merchants of seven nations gather at every solstice and equinox to trade in the bazaars. But more importantly, after the trading is done, as they lie on their empty sacks and barrels, they trade stories. Each word that one of them says, sister, battle, lovers, elicits a story from the others. When you live in a particular city, you are not living in its present story. You may be attracted to it by its city story, but you are participating in the creation of a new story when you live in it. Then you might go away, as people in our continuously mobile world do, to another place. It is imperative, if you are to return to the city, that you narrate its story to yourself or to others before you go back. Otherwise, you will suffer dissonance. You will go back to the city expecting it to be the same story and be confused when it is not. The earlier story, hazily seen in dreams, will be driven underneath the concrete reality of the present one, and it will be lost. When you go back, you find that there is a mapped city and an unmapped city. Mumbai exists on official paper and signs, Bombay in the ghosts of memory. But Bombay is what the taxi drivers know. If I get in a taxi and ask the driver, probably from distant Bihar, resident in the city for not longer than 5 years, to take me to Lady Lakshmibai Jagmohandas Marg, he will scratch his head. But if I tell him to take me to Nepean Sea Road, where I grew up and which no longer exists, he will take me to a specific physical street corresponding to the phantom name. Which is more real, the map or the city? Is New York a city or a life-size map of the city of New York? In all of us, there is the desire to drive in reverse, to go back to our past. I will tell you a story about a man who acted on it. It is a common desire among those displaced by the partition of India and Pakistan in 1947 to make the return crossing, to try to go home again. The great Pakistani writer Intizar Hussain, who I met in Lahore, told me that for 30 years he had tried to get a visa to go back to India, particularly to the village he was born in, Dibai, near Aligarh in Uttar Pradesh. Although he had been living in Lahore since 1947, most of his fiction is set in Dibai. He had been having a recurring dream. I go there to my home and I'm wandering among the houses, those lanes, those palaces, the terraces where we flew kites. And then he described his house for me, constructing it lovingly in the air with his hands. The Muslim quarter began at our house. The terraces of the Hindu houses were so close that at Diwali time, I would reach across, steal oil lamps from the terraces and bring them home. 30 years later, at the invitation of a literary gathering in Delhi, Hussain was able to get a visa to go back. He was in Aligarh and then made an impulsive decision to revisit Dubai, which his visa did not allow him to do. He persuaded an Indian friend to drive him to the village. On the way, he saw the trucks all along the road, the phantom convoys of partition. As they came into the village, he couldn't believe how much it had changed. There used to be a pilgrim's hostel. Where was the hostel? Where was the hospital? Everything had become a bazaar. He looked for his house, but the geography of home had changed. His companion said, "Why don't you ask someone?" I said, "I have come to my own town. I am not going to ask someone else for directions." Hussain got out of the car and wandered the bazaars, but could not locate his birthplace. And something in him would not let him ask a stranger for guidance in the territory of his own childhood, his own dreams. At last, he got back in the car and drove back to Aligarh. He never found his childhood home. He has never gone back. Beware of the past. Turn back to look at it, and the one you love will be cast into hell, like Eurydice. Or you will be turned into a pillar of salt, like Lot's wife. The past is a dangerous place, for it is where home lies. I met Intizar Hussain while I was researching people who had murdered their neighbors during partition. In much of my work, I have dealt with people who do bad things to other people, in Bombay, in Punjab, in Queens, and also in Danbury, Connecticut, the headquarters of the Union Carbide Corporation. I've met hitmen, rogue cops, religious rioters, and mob bosses. And I've realized that a man who has murdered is not entirely defined by it. After he kills a human being, a large, perhaps the largest part of him, is a murderer, and it marks him off from most of the rest of humanity who are not. But that is not all that he is. He can also be a father, a friend, a patriot, a lover. When we try to understand murder, we mistake the part for the whole. We deal only with the murderer and are inevitably left confused about how he became one, so radically different from you and me. Moral complexity in characters is traditionally the province of fiction, from the Mahabharata to Dostoevsky to DeLillo. It's been less successfully treated in journalism, where the bald facts of murder and rape are too powerful and can crush all nuance. But writers such as Gay Talese in Honor Thy Father and Thy Neighbor's Wife and Joan Didion in Slouching Toward Bethlehem show that unsympathetic characters can be dealt with fairly and engagingly in nonfiction as well. I was trained as a novelist before I became a journalist. In writing Maximum City, which is a nonfiction book, I found that it was important to treat all of the people who told me their stories as if they were characters in a novel, as if I was responsible for creating them, making them whole and complex, using E.M. Forster's term, rounded. That means not just allowing bad people, such as murderers, the freedom to be good in other parts of their lives, but also allowing innocents, such as disaster victims, the freedom to be unsympathetic, to be real bastards. In 1995, I lived for 3 months in the Indian city of Bhopal, site of the worst industrial accident in history, where 11 years earlier, on December 2, 1984, a chemical explosion killed 10,000 people. I wrote a two-part series for the Village Voice about the survivors. A number of the Bhopal survivors are highly unsympathetic. There is, for example, a street thug I will call Arun. Arun first learned of the deaths of 7 out of 10 members of his family when he saw their photos stuck up on the wall by the side of the road. He was 14 years old then and became the head of his family, responsible for his little brother and sister. Naturally, the activist organizations and press clustered around him, some using him for their own ends, and he became a kind of traveling professional victim. He started going on tours all over India and twice to the US to talk about the tragedy that had devastated his family. He was a natural. He told me with pride, "At the age of 15, I learned to give such good answers that all the journalists loved me." Arun is not a nice man. He lives off the other survivors and their compensation money. He beats up people, he goes drinking and whoring, and he sells dangerous, out-of-date medicines on the black market. He uses his status as the poster child of the activist movement to financial advantage. Every year on the anniversary of the gas leak, the chief minister holds a big commemorative public meeting and invites a number of the gas victims. Arun goes every year and asks him for a favor, such as a coveted license to sell kerosene, which he'll divert to the black market. The chief minister, he told me with a laugh, will never refuse such a famous orphan anything when there are so many journalists present. Once, when an activist friend was remonstrating with Arun about his misdeeds, Arun responded, "Look at Warren Anderson, the chairman of Union Carbide. He got away with killing so many people. If he can get away, so can I." How do I treat a person like Arun in my article? What would you do if you woke up gasping and vomiting from a gas leak one night, and by the morning, your parents and 5 of your brothers and sisters were dead? I decided to write about all of him, the gas victim as well as the victimizer of other gas victims, and to write about the process that had turned him from one to the other. On the one hand, his life has clearly been devastated, and there are very specific and readily identifiable reasons for his delinquency. On the other hand, there are lots of other survivors who have dealt with loss and not turned out to be criminals. But Arun, for me, illustrates something fundamental. Writing the truth in all its complexity always serves the victims better than a sanitized morality play full of saintly heroes and stock villains. The people who have the greatest need to tell stories are not the victims of atrocities, it is the perpetrators. I was interested to learn that the head of the South Sudanese army, accused of many atrocities, recently enrolled in a creative writing program in Southern California. All of those guys were given visas to come to the US, but nobody would take them into an educational program except this one, an Angolan journalist explained to me. Now, whenever visitors come to the general's office in South Sudan to talk about war or peace, he first shows them his fiction, of which he is very proud. You cannot understand large and complex cities without understanding this kind of moral complexity. I was once on assignment for Harper's Magazine in the Indian city of Varanasi, studying a brutal outbreak of Hindu-Muslim rioting. Varanasi's main industry is exquisite silk saris. Muslims weave them and Hindus sell them. They've been coexisting for centuries. But in the early 1990s, this compact broke down and the city erupted. Dozens of Muslims were killed by Hindus affiliated with the BJP party. So I sought an appointment with the Hindu leader of the BJP, a man who had fomented the riots, and he asked me to come to his house one morning. As I went in, I passed two old Muslim men on his balcony, talking among themselves. I went in and spoke to the Hindu merchant, and he spewed hate against Muslims, telling me nothing I hadn't heard before in India, that Muslims are outsiders, they should have gone to Pakistan at partition, etc., etc. As I was wrapping up this not very valuable interview, I asked him what the two old Muslim men were doing on his balcony. "Oh, they've come to me to settle a property dispute between themselves," he said. "Why you?" I asked. "I thought you hate them." "Yes, but I hate them all equally." If the Muslims went to someone in their own community to adjudicate the dispute, that person would probably be related to or biased against one or the other. But since they knew this Hindu merchant hated them all equally, insofar as they were Muslims, he could render fair judgment in the matter of the property dispute. It's no wonder India drives foreign journalists mad. People there can compartmentalize different parts of their minds. Hypocrisy in this regard is not necessarily seen as a vice. There is no law of the excluded middle in Indian philosophy. Something can be true, false, both, or neither. Novelists are keenly aware that this is also true about human beings. Writers are obsessed with cities because we are obsessed with people. Dickens, Joseph Mitchell, Jane Jacobs, Balzac, Mahfouz. But the best writing being done about cities today is by outsiders. The narrative of Rome is not being fashioned today by people born in Rome. It is written by immigrants to Rome, Libyans, Albanians, the Roma. The story of New York today is being told not by people born there, but by Edwidge Danticat, Juno Diaz, Jhumpa Lahiri, Gary Steingart. People born in New York, like my two sons, are better equipped to tell stories about Moscow, Tegucigalpa, Lagos, but only if they move there and try to make a home of it. Unless, like Calvino, that most humane urbanist, you write about invisible cities. The prose in invisible cities is so general and spacious and inscrutable, it could mean anything to anyone, that it allows you to make your own city, like the Emperor Kublai Khan in the book. Besides Marco Polo and the Khan, there are no individuals in the book, none in any of the cities. There are only assemblages of people. The one exception is the goat herd, eternally lost in the continuous city of Sicilia. A real city that belongs in Calvino's book is the abandoned city of Fatehpur Sikri near Agra, where the Mughal Emperor Akbar shifted his entire court for 14 years, then abandoned it for reasons that are still mysterious. Was it because the riverbed had dried up? Was it over a woman? Why did the ghosts leave Fatehpur Sikri? Perhaps because they were ghosts to begin with. All this was explained to me by my friend Salman Rushdie as he showed me the site where he was researching his novel, Enchantress of Florence. This half-ruined city was perfect for his imagination. He could reconstruct the walls, decorate them with exquisite inlays and fabulous carvings with his fiction. The gaps in the historical record, Rushdie noted, are where the fiction writer can come in. Both fiction and non-fiction, at the most essential level, are about this, the human being struggling underneath the foot of history, personal and political. In Hindu mythology, Shiva dances on one foot with a circle of flame around him, and underneath his foot is a dwarf, struggling to get out from beneath the massive foot of history. History is in his control and out of his control, and it is that struggle that we as writers witness and document. So it is essential for a writer to understand both the global issues such as trade policy and the clash of civilizations that affect the individual sitting in a slum room in Bombay, and such personal things as his love life or his favorite song. It is an exhilarating moment when the human being escapes the history set out for him. I remember a huge rally against police brutality in New York in the wake of the Amadou Diallo shooting in the 1990s. It was a beautiful morning and there was a massive crowd in front of Police Plaza. Speaker after speaker from organizations ranging from Maoists to immigrant rights organizations to anti-war groups got up to the stage to denounce the tactics of the NYPD. Then a nervous young man named Salim got up. The announcer welcomed this representative from the Lease Drivers Coalition, a taxi drivers group. He was Pakistani and he had never addressed such a huge crowd before. Salim walked up onto the stage and there was a wave of applause. He looked at the huge applauding crowd. which expected him to talk about how the cops abused the rights of cabbies, and Salim, feeling empowered like never before in his life, began speaking, I am gay. There was an astonished pause. I'm gay, said Salim, and then an even louder round of applause, including from the cops in front of Police Plaza. I'm gay, he kept saying. He had just come out, as he never could in Pakistan, and he had just addressed what was most powerfully human in himself. For me as a writer, it was a beautiful moment to watch because Salim had just stepped out from underneath the foot of his personal history, out from under the burden of the message, the official story that he was expected to deliver. The differences between the unofficial and the official stories are enormous. If the story of Mumbai is that it is the financial capital of Asia, then we can demolish hundreds of acres of light industry, textile factories, without much scruple, because after all, we need office space. If the story of Mumbai is that it is a collection of villages, then we will keep the mill areas low-lying, preserve the old towns in the city. The problem is that the media, print, and especially electronic, favor one kind of storytelling over the other. They are partial to stories that require big expense budgets, snazzy technology, flashy images. Some of the most elaborate fictions about the city are not found in the work of novelists, but in real estate brochures and city plans. They're a kind of science fiction, an idea of the future. Mumbai's politicians and businessmen have their eyes set firmly on Shanghai as a model for Mumbai. In 2003, the Maharashtra state government asked a group of professional storytellers, the management consulting firm McKinsey, to construct a narrative about the future of Mumbai. So McKinsey came up with a document whose recommendations the state government officially adopted, called Vision Mumbai, which aimed to turn Mumbai into, quote, a world-class city by 2013. As the architect Charles Correa said about the plan, that's not a vision, that's a hallucination. McKinsey wanted to brand the city and ask for my help in this kind of endeavor. Then they read my book and stopped asking. Who gets to brand a city? 99% of the people that come to Bombay are not coming to find Shanghai. They're coming to Mumbai, whose myth is attractive enough for them. It is the international consulting companies that have decided that Bombay must be rebranded as Shanghai to be successful. In New York, I've been studying the plans for the redevelopment of Coney Island. Coney Island exists in the fond nostalgic reveries of older New Yorkers and in the fevered dreams of planners, developers, and civic activists. In other words, Coney Island exists mostly in the past and the future. Its soiled present is too depressing to contemplate. For the stories of the people who actually live and work in the district, in the unimaginable present, are ignored or overlooked. But official narratives will fail if they are not authentic. The government of the Netherlands recently tried to make itself unattractive to potential Muslim and African migrants by creating a film called To the Netherlands, consisting of gay couples kissing, topless women sunbathing. The film is compulsory viewing for prospective immigrants who have to buy a copy costing hundreds of dollars, except those making more than $54,000 a year, or citizens of rich countries like the US, for whom the requirement is waived. The film, To the Netherlands, also shows the crime-ridden ghettos where immigrants might end up living. There are interviews with other immigrants who call the Dutch cold and distant. The film warns of traffic jams, problems finding a job, and flooding in the low-lying country. My friend, the Pakistani writer Mohsin Hamid, one of the residents of the Muslim countries that the Dutch government is so desperately trying to keep out, suggests another track the Dutch might take. They could produce a film extolling Belgium. Wonderful, wonderful Belgium, the almost Holland, but better. One of the most potent forms of storytelling, the one with perhaps the greatest narrative drive, is the story of crime. People living in big cities are fascinated by crime. They read about it in the tabloids, avidly follow sensationalist trials on television, and vote for politicians who promise to fight crime by any means necessary. The governor of Arizona, Jan Brewer, declared last year that the majority of illegal immigrants were, quote, drug mules. Furthermore, the governor said, they're doing drop houses and they're extorting people and they're terrorizing the families. Here it was, out in the open at last, immigration equals crime. Drug dealing extortionists terrorizing families. According to Governor Brewer, a Mexican migrant doesn't make the perilous journey through the desert, braving coyotes of the human and animal variety, to feed his family in Puebla. No, he's crossing the desert to terrorize families in Phoenix. It doesn't matter that police records show that the crime rate has been flat or declining all along the Arizona border for the last decade. The story of the Mexican terrorist is more of a vote catcher. In the roaring 1990s, Mumbai too thought of itself as a violent, gang-ridden city. Hundreds of people were dying every year in wars between rival gangs and extrajudicial killings by the police. The city was convinced of its own menace. The newspaper headlines, the movies suited the gangsters and the cops both. The gangsters because it increased their stature in society. After all, they live on fear. Fear is their sugar solution. And the cops, because the public, afraid of crime, granted them the highest power, the power to take a life without a trial. I got the sense of a city straining to imagine itself more violent than it actually was. So the Mumbai police, like the police in Rio and Sao Paulo and Lagos, are given license to beat and torture people, many of them innocent. The police work within a hierarchy of anger. Anytime there's a gory crime or terror incident that makes the news, people read it and get fearful. The politicians respond to this fear with anger and start screaming at the police commissioner. The commissioner receives the anger, elaborates it, and screams at the precinct commanders. The commander screams at the inspector and so on down the ranks to the lowest constable, who has nobody below him to scream at. So he goes out and starts swinging his baton at street children, cursing and yelling. And the children, all they can do is run. I saw the same phenomenon in Lisbon, in a squatter settlement centrally located in the city called Cabo do Moro. There are 7,000 people living there, mostly migrants from the island African nation of Cape Verde. They serve a function in the city, working as day laborers and domestic servants. They've been living there since the 1960s without any major problems. But the city's developers have their eyes on this prime property, so they've enlisted the press to their cause. I saw a lurid magazine cover with the police in the barrio. It has pictures of corpses, the police handcuffing young black men face down on the ground, and a map of this area designed like a war zone. The article paints a picture of a crime and drug-ridden ghetto, a constant danger to the gentry of Lisbon. Articles like this sensationalize the area and give the municipal government a pretext for demolishing it, to rid it of immigrant crime. It's the same story in Istanbul, which is one of the safest cities in Europe. But the fastest growing segment of housing in Istanbul is the gated communities, both in the center city and the suburbs. These communities are a reaction to crime or the perception of crime. As a result, people pay enormous sums to hire private security guards. If you look at what people in these gated communities actually pay every month in maintenance fees, it would be cheaper to get mugged every month. As in all storytelling, the choice of the words used in the story is crucial. And the most freighted of all these words in the story of the city is the word slum. What is a slum? You and me don't like it, so we call it a slum. The word is loaded, overloaded, toppling. The people in the Mumbai slums have another word for it, busti, or community. A busti abounds in community spaces, in the line to the toilet, the line at the water tap, the patches of empty ground where the kids play cricket, in front of the hundreds of little shops servicing every human need. The construction of the busti is crucial to the spirit of Mumbai that saves the city time and again through floods, riots, and terror attacks. Each room in the busti is exquisitely custom-built, every detail of it, including the walls and the ceilings. Each room is different and, over the decades, suited to its owner's needs. They're endlessly flexible, with partitions and extra stories built according to the number of family members that live there. They are colored outside and in to their owner's taste. Look at a slum colony anywhere in the world. It is multicolored. Then look at the public housing that replaces it when it is demolished. It is almost always monochromatic. It is also anonymous, generic, fungible, a triumph of anomie over community. The buildings look exactly alike, not just in Bombay, but in Sao Paulo, Jakarta, Johannesburg. We marvel at Lisbon's old city. We pay a premium to live in Trastevere or the Marais or the East Village, all considered slums 100 years ago. Our young people now want to live where the other half once lived. A Jewish friend of mine in New York was looking for an apartment in New York's Lower East Side. When her grandmother heard about it, she reminded her, "I spent half my life trying to get out of that place." The poor already live exactly where they want to live and have made an architecture and an urban plan that they can live with. They don't really need planners. And when they are presented with the big plans that the city has for them, they don't understand them. That is because much of the conversation around planning is deliberately arcane, like the Latin Mass. It serves the function of setting up an exclusive class of individuals who are the intermediaries between God and man, between the politicians and developers who have their visions of the city, and the ordinary people who have to inhabit them. The antidote to all of this is another class of storytellers, journalists. The news must return to being a story. Delivery of the news has bifurcated. One track is the idiocies and banalities of cable television news for the masses, and the other consists of the arcane, hyper-specialized, and often nonsensical professional journals that cater to a diminishing elect who have all the real power. Language is power. We are the victims of jargon in the academic journals, in the law courts, in the medical offices. The basic problem with this kind of prose is this: a lot of it could be said more simply. Part of the reason the world was so easily defrauded by the bankers with the talk of derivatives and credit default swaps was that very few people understood what that actually is. Even the government officials, who are supposed to keep a watch, don't really understand it. And it is here that journalism has a central role. We are the intermediaries, the interlocutors, and nobody else can perform this task. It is the responsibility of journalists to penetrate that wall of jargon, to listen to the experts, and then to translate it into English or Hindi, and to communicate to a general audience the deliberations of the powerful and the wealthy, so that the rest of us can make an informed judgment about whether we're getting screwed. In cities, journalists need to pay much more attention to all the millions of unofficial stories out there, and then to retell them compellingly. Nothing less than our collective democratic project depends on this. Thank you.
I have a few questions that came to mind as I was listening. I'm sure other people have questions as well. You know, one of the things you began with was this idea of mobility and that story of the $7,000 Benz in Jackson Heights or Jamaica? It was Jamaica. In Jamaica. I have a vague feeling that I know the person who sold that $7,000 Benz, but maybe we shouldn't go there. But one of the things that's so striking was you started with this idea of mobility and how powerful mobility is as a way of producing insight. You know, the idea of the immigrant having this keen sense of city life that you can't have if you grow up in New York. You don't have the same kind of critical eye. What was fascinating was the parallel signs of success. Your family's Fiat. For my family, it was a Toyota. Obviously, we were very low grade. For this other family, a Benz. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about how objects become a sign of success, but also a foundation for storytelling. I think the thing that was most striking was why the car? But the other thing that was most striking was the part of the story that involved them taking the car and parking it by a subway stop, which is incredibly evocative for thinking about cities, because we can't almost ever extricate cities from the forms of public transport that they're affiliated with. So Paris and the Metro, London and red buses, even London's funny taxis, right? You know, we have other examples, Chicago and the L, and so on and so forth. So that's maybe a lot of questions, but maybe I'll let you take it as you want to.
The first car that my family bought when we moved to Jackson Heights in the 1970s was an Impala. It was in early 1970s Impala. Now, for some reason, I think it was because of the movies, in India, the word Impala was associated with great luxury. Mm-hmm. In New York, it was just the biggest car I had ever seen. It was required a helmsman to steer it. You could really, my sisters and I could all stretch out in the back seat and sleep. But I think my father really got it because he wanted to go to America and, you know, buy an Impala. And it was that specific name that had all these connotations of luxury. And it wasn't just cars. In my book, I have a section where I talk about this idea of the showcase, which most Indian families, either in India or in America, have. And a showcase is a kind of curio cabinet where you put these objects of luxury or souvenirs from travels and whatever, and you kind of exhibit them to people who come to your living room. So in our showcase in Bombay, we had all these imported goods. So this was the 1970s, and when my father and my uncle made business trips to Antwerp, they would get little knickknacks, little matchbox cars, and a British beef eater. If you removed his head, you'd find matches there, and a little model of the Eiffel Tower, and toys that we, the children in the house, were not allowed to touch, but they were just there for show. Lots of cars, these matchbox cars. And then when we moved to New York, we were in Jackson Heights and then this New Jersey suburb called Ridgewood, we had another kind of showcase or curio cabinet filled with objects from India. So a Bharatanatyam doll whose head would bob sideways, and a map of India where all of Kashmir had been reclaimed from the Pakistanis and the Chinese. little lamps and deities and so forth. And again, when my son was born, he wasn't allowed to touch these objects, so he spent his time splayed against glass like a wasp at a window. So these were objects that we, you know, could look at but not touch. When I took my mother to the Metropolitan Museum of Art and we went into this room with these beautiful statues from medieval India of Shiva and Buddha, she said, "I feel like praying. Why is no one praying here?" So it goes back to my story about the car, taking the car to be prayed to. Objects aren't just objects. They have all these meanings. And in India, it's impossible to separate this, the sacred from the profane. You know, about mobility, I just want to, this one story came to mind as I was watching Bijoy's wonderful slideshow about rural India. So we're going to have all these cars, but we don't really have the roads for all these cars to move on, and we don't have the judicial infrastructure to deal with what happens when these cars collide. So on this trip to meet Salman Rushdie in Fatehpur Sikri, I was going from Delhi to Agra, and it was just supposed to be a pretty fairly short trip of 2 or 3 hours. And then as we were driving, we found that the road was completely blocked. There were no traffic was moving. And then the driver, without, you know, being perturbed at all, just crossed over to the other side of the highway and drove straight onto oncoming traffic, which parted like the Red Sea before Moses. But at a certain point, even that had stopped, and all these people were moving away from this scene where there had been a traffic accident, where a truck carrying green peas, this is the winter and it was the season of, you know, peas, and all around us saffron fields and mustard fields, and the road was filled with these spilled peas and human blood, because he'd run over a laborer who was crossing the highway. Now, all along the highway, there are these karkhanas, these small factories where, you know, people make things which are unlicensed. And the laborers, you know, when they want to get from one side to the other, they do not recognize that this is a highway off limits to pedestrians, so they get run over. Now, the entire road had been blocked, and I asked my driver, he at this point then just pulled off onto the fields and started driving to the fields. And I said, let's just stay on the road. He said, no, if you stay here, we'll be here all day long, because not even the police will come now, no politicians will come now, because they'll get lynched. And then I realized that this is the only defense that the laborers have. So they had gathered onto the road, and they were waiting for some politician to come and give the family of the dead laborer money. Because they knew that if they went to the courts, it would take 20 years before anything would get settled. And the truck driver, meanwhile, had just run off, because he knew that if he stayed in the car, then he would get killed or certainly beaten up. So before, I think you have all these cars, I think it also, I mean, the country really needs to think about the kind of infrastructure it has, not just the roads, but also a dispute resolution mechanism, a system of torts, where something as simple as a traffic accident can get resolved.
Thank you. So I want to turn to your question, to what you said about fiction and nonfiction, and that you were trained in fiction makes a lot of sense. And as you were talking, particularly about your work on Union Carbide, but also, again, the narrative of promotion through buying a car, I was reminded of two novels, White Tiger, which probably many of you have read, by Arvinda Diga, who I won't give away the story, but it's a story of a rickshaw puller's son who's kind of promoted to becoming a driver of a Honda City. And it's a big part of the narrative. He gets another promotion along the way that is also a parable told through the car. There's another novel that, particularly about Union Carbide, Animals, People by Indra Sinan. I don't know if you've read that. And of course, I gave you great credit for Sacred Games. I'm sure that you were involved in that. How much does fiction play a role in how you tell your stories about the city, given that there are so many novels about the city out there?
Well, I'm bitextual. I write fiction and nonfiction both. I began writing fiction. And, you know, in my family, in much of India, there isn't much of a line between fiction and nonfiction. And it's how events are explained. I mean, if you go to the villages and you listen, or once I was listening to a temple priest in Karnataka, and I was with my friend, the great Kannada writer, U.R. Anantamurti, and he was translating for me what the priest was saying. So he was talking, you know, telling them the story of the Ramayana, and had this great myth of Ram and Sita in exile, and then they are passing through the forests, they're far from Ayodhya, and there's Ram, Sita, and Lakshman. And then he says, and they were sitting in their forest hermitage, and then they heard some very disturbing news about this village. So-and-so was having an affair with so-and-so's wife. And Ram said to Lakshman, you must go and investigate and tell me the truth and find out what's happening in this village. So, you know, they're going to find out, and, you know, whoever's having the affair, they'll be in trouble. And then he continued with the story of Sita getting kidnapped and going on to Sri Lanka. Now, this is a story that happened thousands of years ago in the mythic past, and he was conflating it with a very specific event in the village that he wanted to call attention to, some kind of extramarital affair. So I was fascinated by this conflation of mythic time and real time of, you know, fiction and nonfiction. I later Well, I went to the Iowa Writers' Workshop. I'm a licensed fiction writer. But then I moved to New York, and I realized that if you change a couple of letters in the Iowa Writers' Workshop, it becomes the Iowa Writers' Workshop, which is an appellation far more indicative of the eventual fate of most of its graduates. So I ventured into journalism, and I found journalism really interesting, and this kind of narrative journalism. There aren't many writers who can do both well. So V.S. Naipaul comes to mind, and of course, George Orwell and Tom Wolfe. And this kind of writing was new in India. And I wanted to go home after 21 years abroad. I wanted to go home to Bombay, and I wanted to find a way of writing about it, which would make sense to me. Midnight's Children made me leave the diamond market and made me want to be a novelist, but Salman had already done that, so I didn't see that I could do much more in that vein. And then the journalism became interesting. I went to Bombay to write an article for the British magazine Granta on the riots in 1992-93, and I got to meet all these people in these different worlds of the city. So the form of my book was something that I had no idea what kind of book I'd write going in. So I decided to create this kind of hybrid form. And it is all nonfiction. I don't make anything up. And a lot of it was came from my conversations with architects and planners, notably Rahul Mehrotra, who was kind enough to spend many hours with me chatting about the future of the city. And I thought that, and I said this to Rahul, that the future of cities is too important to be left to the people who professionally plan cities. So it should involve novelists and journalists and woodworkers and car designers and corporate CEOs. And the problem is that there isn't enough of this kind of interdisciplinary conversation happening about the future of Mumbai. There's about 27 different agencies which have responsibility for different parts of the city, which is right such a mess. There's some are central government agencies, some are state government agencies, some are local agencies. And it's the same thing with the conversation around the city. The city, like all great cities, lives in a series of bubbles, and people don't go from one bubble to the other. And I think what's really needed is this kind of interdisciplinary conversation among many different people who are all in love with the same city.
Thank you. So I think we'll open it up for questions. And I know Elise is wandering around with a microphone.
Thanks very much. I want to just follow the last point and wonder if you say a little more about what such a conversation should look like. I mean, in a democratic politics, of course, the premise is that the city is too valuable to leave to the professionals. So there must be a broader conversation. But is it a dialogue? Is it a debate? Is it something else again? I mean, it's really a question. What happens when passionately held stories conflict? Because these are stories about our future, stories about our children, stories about what's at stake in our lives. And there are conflicts between them. So what's your sense of the working out of the conflict of wonderfully, deeply held stories?
Well, Jane Jacobs was mentioned earlier, and I think Death and Life of Great American Cities is just a perfect example of someone who was not a professional urbanist or architect, but who loved cities, and was an activist and a writer. So when Robert Moses was asked, what force stopped his grand plans to drive a four-lane highway through Washington Square Park, he answered with disgust, mothers. So Jane Jacobs got together a bunch of mothers who were in Washington Square Park, who used it as a playground for their kids, and got them involved in the conversation, and so saved Greenwich Village. And I see there are really brave and wonderful groups of these mothers, of activists, people who love the city in Bombay, who are trying to create this kind of conversation. This conversation must happen in the universities. It must begin here, because this is where this university, like all great universities, has talent in so many areas. You have writers, you've got designers, you've got architects, planners, and like the university I'm in, NYU, like most of the universities I've gone in, these departments tend to be separate. So if there is a metropolitan studies department, it doesn't have enough to do with the creative writing department. And I think that this is certainly one place where we could have a discussion, and by all means, the discussion might be an argument. There could be, you know, objects thrown. That would be fine too. It would be like the Maharashtra State Assembly, where people, you know, regularly come to fisticuffs, as they say in the Indian papers. And at one point, the Congress Party got so tired of getting beaten up regularly in the Maharashtra Assembly that they gave a safe seat to a professional wrestler from District Sangli, whose job it was to rush out in the assembly well and take on all comers. So that's one kind of conversation about cities. But I think that in the magazines like The New Yorker and The Atlantic, where someone like Malcolm Gladwell, who goes out and speaks to experts and listens to them, and then translates it into easily accessible prose, that kind of conversation is crucial. I'm writing about Coney Island right now for The New Yorker, and I have been speaking to planners and architects, and I've also been speaking to members of street gangs who live there. I'm friendly with a group of Crips who live in a housing project in Coney Island. And I spoke to them for 4 hours the other night, and they had all these really perceptive comments to make about urban planning, about the future of Coney Island, because they'd been living there, and they knew what the developers wanted, they knew how housing worked, they knew about economics and the poor, they knew about gentrification, and I very much doubt that any of the planners have actually gone and spoken to the Crips. They've done these workshops, these charrettes, where community leaders come and speak. But I think the conversation has to go beyond that. So I'll give you another example. I was in Dharavi speaking this, the largest slum in Asia. And I was speaking to a person who has a leather workshop. So he lives in this two-story shack, and he has his workshop on the bottom, and his family, so his wife and two children, live on the top. Now, they work for 14 hours, and he says, I see my children in these 10-minute gaps when I can. Now, the government of Maharashtra has this plan for changing Dharavi, demolishing the shacks, and then giving them public housing, so, you know, a 273 square foot flat. Now, the problem is that the replacement housing that the government plans does not have space for his workshop. And he says, if you make me move from my shack, I won't see my children. So I wondered why the people who were making these plans for Dharavi hadn't bothered to go in and speak to people like him and ask him what he might like for his city.
Well, I'm interested in the distinction that you make, and you seem to be doing it actually very categorically between the official and the unofficial. I mean, we found that, just talking to very ordinary people in Bombay, one of the things that they seem to sort of buy in readily is actually, say, the story of the Seven Islands. You know, it's become, I mean, it was the official story of the English that has now become the ordinary story of every taxi driver in Bombay. Is there the official that weaves through the unofficial, and can you separate them categorically? But that also is related to this other aspect that you talk about, an interdisciplinary team, I mean, interdisciplinary kind of get together around the city. Because the way you put it was, you said that people are in love with the same thing. Are you sure they're seeing the same thing? I mean, it's not the question of the blind man and the elephant. I mean, there's no elephant there. What makes you so sure there's a thing?
Well, there's a thing because they're living in it. There's a certain geographical area in which they live, they work. And most of the people that I've seen, they still have this passion about this thing, this idea of the city. Now, the actual city means different things to different people. And the people now who are living in New Bombay, in this row after row of these apartment buildings, have very little to do with the older Parsis and Sindhis who live near the Oval. But there is still an intangible idea of Bombay, Mumbai, Bombay, this venerated object that will lift each of us, that will give us a better life, a better opportunity, that will give us a certain kind of freedom. When I spoke about the official and the unofficial cities, I was really speaking about a kind of power attached to each of these conceptions of stories. So the official story has no power because it's got the power of money, of politics behind it. And the unofficial story is kind of elliptical, quieter, subversive. It doesn't mean that the people who create the unofficial stories are not appreciative of, subject to the official story. They take the official story and subvert it. So this is where, you know, the Hindi movies, Bollywood, are really instructive. In my book, I've written about the influence of the Bollywood movies on style and architecture in the Bombay slum, this concept of Shan. So it's difficult to know where one begins and the other ends. But when I was speaking about these different kinds of storytelling, I think the imperative is to pay more attention to the unofficial story because it shapes the official one in more ways than we recognize.
There a question? Yeah, Rishi.
Hi. I know you in your talk you spoke about journalism in India a little bit. So what I wanted to ask was a city like Mumbai, where around 30-35% people, 40% people live in slums. What do you think those stories and how journalism in India can help get those stories to people? Because I feel those are the people who are actually gonna, as you said, like in Coney Island, when you gave that example, that those are gonna be the people who are gonna drive the future of the city and how big their perspective is towards what the future of Mumbai should be and how journalism in India, which has been doing very little to get those perspectives into people and what they should do in the future of the city.
Well, when I want to really find out what's happening in the slums, I don't read the Times of India. I read Lok Satta. I read the Marathi papers. And in most of the country, the vernacular press has more of a finger on the pulse of people. They're also, I don't mean to romanticize them, they're also responsible for spreading a great deal of rumors and hatred. In the Gujarat riots, the Gujarati papers were extremely culpable in creating this kind of communal hatred. The kind of journalism that we're seeing is in India, it's extremely robust. There's some terrific investigative journalists out there. But much of it is just people yelling and shouting at each other. Which is also, well, another kind of democratic debate. It's now, I believe, around 60% of the people in Bombay who live in informal housing or, you know, what we might call slums. So that is the future of the city. But it's not like they don't have agency. In my book, I talk about the two general elections that I witnessed where on the same day, I would go from where I lived in Malabar Hill to the slum settlements of Jogeshwari. And in Jogeshwari, everybody was out on the road talking about politics, you know, legally, illegally participating in democracy. And I looked at the turnout rates. They were around 90% in Jogeshwari. And then back in Malabar Hill, it was just an excuse for a holiday. And the turnout in Malabar Hill is around 30%. And most of that is the slum colonies in and around the buildings of the poor. So I think the difference between the world's two great democracies, India and the US, is that in India, the poor vote. And the people who've come into Bombay, you know, now it's about 30% North Indian, the city. And these are people who come in with a keen sense that they have to participate in democracy, they have to go out and vote for their leaders, corrupt or not, because if they don't, for them, it makes the difference between having a roof over their heads or not. And their information networks are very different from the information networks of the better off in Bombay. So people in Malabar Hill might, you know, read the English language newspapers, watch television, so forth. People in the slums rely much more on these unofficial stories, on what their neighbor tells them, what their caste leader tells them, what their priests tells them, what the local dada tells them. There's much more of this orally transmitted information about the news of the world. And also how to, I was really struck by their extremely nuanced grasp of the political process. So I saw this campaign worker for the Congress Party giving a speech. And the Congress had been in power in the state for the previous 6 years. And he said, I know that you guys don't like the Congress, you think we're corrupt, and you want to vote in the BJP Sena. But look, we've been in power for 6 years. We have eaten a lot. We have eaten enough. And if you vote for the BJP, they're very hungry. They will eat more than us. So vote for us because we have eaten our fill. And the crowd perfectly understood this rationale.
Thank you.
से खुद की कैसी ये जंग है पल पल ये दिल घबराए पल पल ये दिल शर्माए कुछ कहता है और कुछ कर जाए कैसी ये पहेली मुआ दिल मर जाना इश्क में जल्दी बड़ा जुर्माना तू सब्र तो कर मेरे यार जरा सांस तो ले दिलदार चल फिक्र नु गोली मार यार है दिन जिंदड़ी दे चार हौले हौले हो जाएगा प्यार छलिया हौले हौले हो जाएगा प्यार हौले हौले हो जाएगा प्यार छलिया हौले हौले हो जाएगा प्यार हौले 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 हौले